Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. It's made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent, and I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. Christmas decorations stock shelves as soon as Halloween is over. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, every year holidays seem to push more and more for consumerism and less in meaning. An often overlooked impact of the commercialization of the holiday season is the hidden cost to our environment. Are we doing more harm than good with our altruistic giving? Can we shop smarter and be more mindful as consumers? And what can we do to do our part to conserve the environment resources and protect the planet while taking part in a joy of gift giving? Today's guests are going to share their thoughts about the importance of sustainability and conscious consumerism during the holidays. And joining me in the studio today are Kyle Weens, CEO and co-founder of iFixit, a global repair community who are fixing the world one broken gadget at a time. Aaron Gomez, newly elected San Luis Obispo County member, council member, and co-owner of the environmentally sustainable jewelry store, The Gold Concept. And Lynn Ann Wiest, store manager of Humankind Fair Trade, a nonprofit retail store. Today's show is live, and we invite you to join our conversation with your comments and your questions. And you can do that by calling us at 805-781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. And thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with you, Kyle, because I want to hear from each of you about just kind of an overview of your companies, how you started them and what they are. So I'm going to start with you.
Well, thanks for having me on. iFixit is a small company with a big mission. Our goal is to teach everybody how to fix all their stuff. And the reason for that is that we feel like we're moving into a disposable economy where we buy things, use them for a little while, and toss them away. And we'd like to live in a world where people care more about their things. So iFixit has free open source step-by-step repair guides for all kinds of things. It could be a KitchenAid mixer, it could be an iPhone, it could be a bicycle. Our goal is to teach you how to fix all your stuff. And the hope is that if you have something that's broken, like you pull out your Christmas lights to put them up, and half a strand isn't lighting up, and so you punch into Google, half my Christmas lights aren't lighting up, and you end up on a site like iFixit, and we have instructions on how to repair your Christmas lights so you don't have to throw them away and buy new ones.
How long has the company been around, Kyle?
We've been doing it for about 12 and a half years. Started in the dorms at Cal Poly fixing laptops and wrote repair manuals for laptops first. And since then, we've expanded into all kinds of other things. But it's not us writing the manuals. It's really a community. So we're kind of like Wikipedia for fixing things. We want to make it as easy as possible for people to fix all their stuff.
And you do this globally?
Yes, we're in 11 languages around the world. Wow. Last year, I was looking this morning, we had 92 million people that fix things on iFixit in the last 12
months. That's incredible. I'll have to talk to you about fixing my phone soon. And Aaron, I'm going to go to you.
Thank you for having me. So I'm co-owner with my brother of The Gold Concept, which my dad started back in 1971, fresh out of Cal Poly as well. He was actually casting, I think, some of his original pieces at Cal Poly and then taking them to the store. So we took over about 6 years ago, and we really re-geared it towards focusing on sustainability. And within the jewelry industry, I mean, that's really based around sourcing and labor. It's an international market, obviously, so you're getting things from all around the world. The upside of jewelry and the sustainability process is it's kind of geared that way because you can endlessly recycle metal. And the biggest issue is labor, and the mining practices are very detrimental environmentally. You're moving a lot of dirt for a very small item, which obviously has big repercussions when you think about the carbon footprint for that, and then you're shipping them all over the world. Mm-hmm. So that's why we really try and focus on local when we can. We actually vet all of our everybody that we carry. They have to go through a sustainable process as far as they have to let us know what their labor practices are, where they're sourcing materials, if they are international, How does that play into their sustainability model? And also beyond that, what are they doing philanthropical to, you know, give back to the community that they get items from?
That's quite an undertaking. Do you vet that then, or, you know, on top of just getting the information from them?
Yeah, because I mean, there's certain things they have to adhere to. If they don't, then we cannot carry them. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit harder for some of the smaller handmade right. things, as far as, because they're still getting items sourced, but it's harder for them to trace as much as larger companies, where they're from start to finish, they can give us a much bigger picture of how that tracing goes.
Great. And Lynn Ann.
Yeah, I'm the manager at Humankind Fair Trade. We are a nonprofit fair trade retail store located downtown San Luis. And we carry handmade items made by artisans in developing countries. Everything that we source is handmade from artisans all around the world. We make sure that they get paid fair wages for their work and have good working conditions. And that's really our mission, is to support those artisans and make sure they can provide for their families by just purchasing their products and supporting their own craft businesses. So being a nonprofit, we do have a board of directors, and we are mostly volunteer run, which is really interesting. We have two paid staff and then a staff of about almost 30 volunteers right now. So it's a really unique community effort. The store was started about 7 years ago by community members who wanted to see this kind of store in our community. And it's been in business ever since.
So the word fair trade has been bantered here a couple of times. Can you guys talk a little bit more about what fair trade is, what it looks like to really have fair trade as the baseline for your products?
Right. Yeah, fair trade is really a way of doing business that puts the needs of the producer first. When you think about a mainstream brand, they want to make as much money as possible. They want to keep as much of what they're earning for themselves, and so they want to pay their producers as little as possible. Fair trade really turns that upside down. We say we want to support the producer first. That's our complete mission. And then we set our prices just based on what we need to do to cover our own expenses.
And for you, Aaron, fair trade in your industry of jewelry?
It's a little bit different, because there's not as, I think, many third parties that are judging the operations as much as in kind of garment and other industries. So for a way for us to get around that is to know where the labor is actually coming from. With smaller artists, that's really easy, because we know exactly who's making it. You know, we've got artists in Santa Cruz, San Francisco. We mm-hmm. make our own jewelry, so that is really easy. When it gets to gem sourcing, that's where it gets difficult, because you've got mining practices, right. you've got them sending to cutters, and then you've got cutters sending somewhere else. So you've got all these steps that it's not easy to trace, because there's not one organization that's necessarily looking at them. With diamonds, they go through the Kimberley process, which, you know, is the kind of the, for lack of a better term, is the anti-blood diamond, you know, movement.
What does that mean?
So this, obviously everybody's seen the movie Blood
Diamond. The Blood
Diamond,
right. Yeah. But maybe not everybody.
I'm sure for those who haven't, you can look it up. Leonardo, I think, was in that one. When that movie came out, it became a really hot topic for the diamond industry. It's not that they didn't have fair labor practices going on, but this shed a light on the fact that there are third world countries that are involved in the diamond process, because that's where so many of them are mined. And that country may not be doing it in a fashion that people feel comfortable with.
Meaning that it's forced labor in some cases.
And it's more, I think, what it's funding. You're looking at the idea of a blood diamond. It's funding war-torn areas.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a monetary infusion from that product being so expensive.
You have unsafe working practices in a lot of these mines. Mm-hmm. You have environmental degradation caused. The amount of raw material involved in mining gold is massive. And if you don't do that in a way that takes care of the environment around it, it can lead to massive erosion. We have a lot of environmental problems in the U.S. from mining that we did a few hundred years ago, and we stopped doing those kinds of mining because we decided they're not environmentally sustainable. But in a lot of the world and in most of the places where we get precious diamonds, precious stones and precious metals, the mining practices are not as not nearly up to the level of what would be acceptable here.
Right. And for you too, Kyle, you're coming at it from a standpoint of once people possess items, maintaining those, keeping those, not having to trade up for something that's
right.
always better. How did that develop for you? I mean, you went from computer repair.
Yes, yeah, so it's driven by understanding how much material impact is actually in these things. My iPhone took over 500 pounds of raw material to manufacture that iPhone, and it's pretty much unrecyclable. There's very, very little of a cell phone that we can get back in recycling. There's no way to take a truck full of old cell phones, grind them up in the recycling plant, and make new cell phones
right.
out of it. Out of the 50 different elements that are in a cell phone, about 12 are recoverable in recycling. The lithium in the battery, which comes from some interesting geographic sources, lithium isn't recoverable. The cobalt generally comes from Congo, which is a conflict region, and it's not recoverable in recycling. The neodymium in the microphone and in the speaker is a rare earth that comes from really environmentally destructive mines in northern China. Those aren't recoverable in recycling. So I started looking at the picture, and I was saying, well, all of us want these new electronic gizmos, and like new gadgets are enriching our lives, but there's this massive cost to manufacture them. So what can we do to figure out a way to make sure that all of us have the technology that we need, but also cause the least possible environmental harm and the least possible social harm? And that's about trying to figure out how to take every single device that we manufacture and use it for as long as possible. And that's what we're trying to do. We're going to say, okay, if there was 500 pounds of raw material that went into my phone and all of the social implications and environmental implications of that, let's extend the life of that phone as long as possible.
And so it may be for that one consumer, but it may also be repurposing.
It could be repurposed. It could be I use a phone for a couple of years and then I sell it and someone else uses it.
Right.
I think that the single most environmentally beneficial organization in the United States is Craigslist. They're phenomenal at what a good job they do at extending the life of products. You get it from someone that doesn't need it anymore to the next person who's gonna utilize it. And the goal with everything, if we're going to go out and buy things, it's imperative that we understand the impact of that and say, okay, I'm willing to, I need this thing, so I'm willing to kind of undertake the cost for that. But in exchange, I'm gonna get maximum utility out of that. And that's where I think, having local retailers where, you're going to go and maybe you're going to pay a little bit more than you might elsewhere. But you have a story associated with that. You have a location, the person that you purchase it from, and it's going to be part of your life in a different way than something that you just get from Walmart or from Amazon that's just a cookie cutter off of an assembly line.
Yeah, yeah. If you just joined us, you're listening to Central Coast Voices here on KCBX, your public radio station. And today's topic is the importance of sustainability and conscious consumerism during the holidays and how you can play your part this season. My guests are Kyle Weins, CEO and co-founder of iFixit, a global repair community who are fixing the world one gadget at a time. Aaron Gomez, newly elected San Luis Obispo City Council member and co-owner of the environmentally sustainable jewelry store, The Gold Concept, and Lynn-Ann Wiest, store manager of Humankind Fair Trade, a nonprofit retail store. Your voice also matters to us. This show is live and we're taking calls. We'd love to hear your thoughts and comments on today's topic. To join our conversation, call us at 805-781-3875. Again, 805-781-3875. And Kyle, I want to go back to you because on your website, I thought it was really fascinating, not something that I had ever really thought about, was the clothing mm-hmm. aspect. I mean, you have to admit, I do like clothing. But just the amount of during the holidays, the sure. amount of disposal and the wastage. And can you talk about that?
It's interesting because clothes are one of the things that is easiest to repair.
Yeah.
A lot of clothing repairs, I know a lot of guys in particular that have a button that falls off a shirt and then they throw the shirt away.
They don't wear it.
They don't wear it anymore. And it's kind of crazy because particularly dress shirts are one of the few things that actually comes with spare parts on the shirt.
I know.
There's an extra two buttons at the bottom of every shirt. So, like, these things are clearly designed to be repaired. And, you know, if you've ever stayed at a hotel and gotten a free sewing kit, right, you've got a needle and thread.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, you've got the spare part, you've got the tool. And then the question is, well, I've never sewn a button back on, so how do we do it? So we have a really easy step-by-step guide for how to sew on a button.
On your website.
On our website, right. And that's, I mean, we've got instructions on how to swap out the battery in your iPhone, which might be challenging and complicated. It's not that bad, but you can also learn how to do simple repairs like putting a button back on. Or you can do, we have instructions on how to do complex repairs like replacing the zipper on a jacket, which might be a several-hour project and require a sewing machine.
And also along this topic, what your website was pointing out is the amount of clothing that goes into landfills. You're talking about things that can be repurposed not only by that individual but by others. And
right.
They're and, just thrown away.
And that's something that we've seen is, you know, we all want things that are unique. And one of the interesting ways to make something unique is to take something and patch it and fix it. And sometimes if you're going to sew a patch back on to a pair of jeans or to an old jacket, maybe sew on a different color patch so that you can kind of advertise that it's unique. We work with Patagonia down south of us a little bit. They're fantastic. And they have a truck that goes around the country. It's called the Worn Wear Truck. Mm-hmm. And they have seamstresses. There's a seamstress from Morro Bay who goes around the country on the truck, and she fixes garments for people. And you bring it, and she'll either show you how to do it yourself or she'll do the repair for you. I think that's really cool.
That's great. And Aaron, for you, I'm curious how you and your family got involved in this sustainability and this particular approach to the business that you have.
So before I answer that, just because we were talking about garment, I think it's really important that people do understand the repercussions of that industry in general. I mean, if you haven't seen the movie, there's a great documentary called True Cost that goes into the garment industry. And just because something is inexpensive, there are major repercussions on a labor side, on an environmental side, from anywhere from farming to actual labor practices.
Right.
So, I mean, people really need to, I think, dig into that a little bit when they think about consumerism.
And probably because it is inexpensive, it's more than likely.
Exactly. I mean, you think of every single thing, it boils down to labor. I mean, everything that we consume, what it costs is based on how much we had to pay somebody to both pull that from the ground, to grow that product, to market it, to get it to your table. So there's a million people in that process. So anytime something is less expensive than the next, you had to cut somebody out of that process. It's either efficiency through robotics or it's efficiency through forcing a certain portion of that labor market to take less money for that product.
Right.
And we always see it on this end, you know, being a consumer society in first world country, we don't necessarily ponder who got taken out of that
we
equation.
We just see the savings.
Yeah, exactly. Us. It's like, oh, I save $5. Well, that $5 costs something somewhere
and
along
the
line. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
And you mentioned too, Lynn-Ann, when you were providing me information, you'd mentioned the factory in Bangladesh.
Right.
What was this, 2 years ago or last year?
Yeah, in 2014, there was a factory in Bangladesh that collapsed, and over 1,000 people died. So it was a garment factory, and the morning that the workers went to work, they noticed cracks in the walls, and their bosses said, get to work anyways. And that day was just tragic for so many families.
And this factory was producing clothing for some major American retailers.
Right, yeah. Some large companies, and these are companies that are so disconnected from these factories. You know, they're just contracting with these other factories. So the system is really set up so that that the brands, they're not actually producing anything. They're just contracting with other factories, and so it's really easy for them to kind of wash their hands of some of the atrocities that are there.
Does that play into with Humankind? Now, you don't have American-made products.
Correct.
That you're selling in your
yeah.
store.
Yeah.
Does that play into that at all, or is that What is the reason for that?
So we carry just things made by artisans in developing countries because we want those people in Bangladesh and in India and in countries all over the world to be able to have good jobs producing clothing and other sorts of things. We do carry several great clothing brands. Most of them are sourced from India, Nepal, and Peru. And so the companies that we work with, we make sure that they are treating their workers fairly. There's some great videos out there of them interviewing the women working in their factories, and you hear from the women just how thankful they are to have these jobs, that they're able to send their kids to school, and they have just a wonderful community among their own factory workers. So there's some really good companies out there, and the garment industry is one that it's really, sometimes it's kind of overwhelming. You see just how many problems there are, how many sweatshops there are. And so sometimes that can be just overwhelming to the consumer. But once you start looking, there's some really wonderful companies all over the world, really, that are producing sustainably made clothing using ethical labor. So you just have to start looking for it. And Humankind is a place to start.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to go back to you, Aaron, and back to my question about how your family came to this approach. What was the reasoning behind that?
I think my family came to this approach because I forced them to.
Okay. So this came from you?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't necessarily a model that my dad had built the company on as far as sustainable jewelry making. Again, jewelry does lend itself to that factor just because of – it's a precious metal. You don't just say, oh, this didn't work, and throw it away.
It's
like everything gets recycled. All your filings gets recycled. Everything from your buffing machine, which every ring that gets buffed, a little bit of gold comes off. You take that, and we send that to a refinery, and they get the gold out and get it back. But I got really more curious about it because after apprenticing under my dad to learn jewelry, my first class was actually a green jewelry course, green meaning, sustainable. And so they really delved into safe practices within your own business as far as how you handle chemicals and how much gold you're able to recover to the repercussions of the mining process in general, everything from gold and all your precious gems. And then where they're coming from and safer sources. And just also asking those questions to your suppliers. Is this American made? If it's not American made, then where is it coming from? And I mean, I'm just interested in sustainability in general. So it made sense to also ask those questions within our own industry and seeing where we can get ahead of, the curve on that process and maybe get some of our suppliers to ask those questions to others.
Do people know when they come into Gold Concept that this is really kind of at the heart of the Gold Concept right now? Or do they come for that reason? Or is it just kind of they just come for jewelry and that happens to be a benefit?
It's a little of both. My favorite part about talking to people is the education side of it, not necessarily the selling side of it. I don't know that I'm a great salesperson, but for those who are
good
really
thing you have
interested,
your brother too. Huh?
Yeah, and we have a great team as well. Our manager's been with us the whole time that me and him have been there, and she actually really makes that side of it tick. But to me, it is about educating people, and some people do come in with those questions already, usually more of the younger generation. And then just through the process, those who are interested will get to learn a few of those fun facts of, lab-grown diamonds versus mined diamonds and, how the industry is shifting on that sense. But we don't promote it as well as we could, I'm sure.
Do you think that because there is a cost difference a lot of times, correct?
Yes.
So is that something that people becoming more aware that there may be a cost difference from the wallet, but there's a cost plus in terms of the environment, the social environment? Is that something that we're beginning to see, or do we have a long way to go in that?
Yeah, I think there is sometimes a higher cost for the consumer to buying ethically made products. But when you think about it, it's just like the movie The True Cost. It's all about breaking down what is the the cost to the environment and to the people producing those products. You know, somebody somewhere is paying the price for our cheap products. And I think sometimes we use that as an excuse to not buy sustainably made products. Now, when just thinking about the garment industry, we've been kind of conditioned to think in terms of how much something is supposed to cost. And the cost or the prices of our clothing right now is so incredibly cheap in the mainstream market. And it just really doesn't reflect what it actually takes to produce garments. And so I think what people can do when they're really concerned about the prices of items, there's a lot you can do to keep those costs under control. I mean, I look at my closet and I have, you know, dresses that I bought for $80 made from organic cotton. And then I have dresses that I bought for $10 at a thrift store. Mm-hmm. And so it really all evens out. And those are two very good options when you're thinking about buying ethical clothing, is the secondhand, and there's the aspect of repairing things you already have. And then so that kind of offsets the cost of some higher priced items.
It seems like in general we're buying more things than we necessarily need.
Right.
Yeah. If you look at European closets, they tend to have about a third as many garments as we do.
Yeah.
And so we're like, well, we want it for less money, but you can, I mean, you could just get half as many things and pay twice as much and it's the same.
Right.
Or pay a little bit less. And I think there's something, you know, we're being bombarded with advertisements all the time, and every single company out there, their goal is to sell you more. And so we have to internalize and come up with some kind of mental kind of mechanisms for fighting back against that, because you're probably fine with everything that you have right now. You probably don't need anything really dramatically new.
Right.
And you think about Christmas, and the gifts that mean the most are probably the gifts that have a bit more time attached to them. We're doing a Secret Santa gift exchange at the office right now, and a lot of our folks are really trying hard to make things rather than just going and buying something, because it's going to mean more.
Yeah, yeah. Aaron, with your company and you stepping into this, do you become more and more aware? Kyle, I'm looking at Kyle and saying Aaron. Both Kyle and Aaron are looking very confused right now. Kyle, with you know, this company, do you become more aware each time that there's something new that even shocks or surprises you?
Sure. Well, and we have to learn how to fix all of these new kinds of things. Yeah. So one of the major things that I've been learning how to repair the last year has been drones and these quadcopters that everybody has, and they're really cool. But the first thing that happens, you fly it, you break it. And so
right.
We're learning how to teach people how to fix these things. The diversity of types of things that we can have is mind-blowing. It's almost like, oh, there's a new type of hammer, like I need to have that, or there's a new style, like I need one of those.
Right.
And this idea that you have to fill up, you know, every possible nook and cranny of your house with a new thing, because the fact that it exists means I must have it. And there's something that's kind of natural and human and instinctive, like we're gatherers intrinsically.
Yeah.
So we have to find a way to fight past that.
So what is the answer for that? Because we're really fighting this consumerism that honestly starts blasting us, radio, television, print. Just at the stores, you can't go.
Right.
You can't go into a store and not have it.
Right.
You know, the way that everything's set up. I mean, what?
I think it comes down to having fewer things that you care about more, and having stories behind each of those things.
Mm. You know what? That's a really interesting point. I can't think of stories that are behind a lot of the things that I own, because there isn't. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what kind of the cusp that we're on right now with consumerism is. It takes a cultural shift. It takes that, even the idea of how you announce a show, being mindful and conscious of what you're consuming. Well, that means you have to do a little bit of homework on it as well, and you need to be aware of that chain that it took to get that product to you. And if you're more aware of that and you're more concerned about the community that affects, it's also your own community. I don't know, maybe Kyle can talk about this, but I remember Yvon Chouinard from Patagonia, the founder, and I think two other did a Harvard study, and they're trying to, and maybe they have at this point, I don't know, but they were trying to basically get a true dollar cost on the entire mechanism when it comes to creating in their industry, the garment industry, in the sense of, you know, organic cotton versus non-organic cotton. Yeah. What's the long-term environmental effect of that? And all the different aspects of it. And when they look at those numbers, then it causes a company that doesn't necessarily care about sustainability, but they care about their bottom line, their longevity of their product. So if they are able to consume organic cotton, but understand that those farms will actually outlast the non-organic, mm-hmm. then they see the benefit from a purely economic scale. And I think that's, I don't care if somebody gets in sustainability because of economics or they're just very green people, as long as they get into sustainability. And it's showing that model can work in our economic model that I think is going to cause some real shifts within industry.
Did you want to speak to the Patagonia thing that you...
Sure. Well, yeah, this question of externalities is really hard. If you look at in Butte, Montana, there's the Berkeley Pit, which is the biggest Superfund cleanup site in the U.S.
It's a Superfund?
Superfund is the EPA's program for cleaning up environmental disasters.
Okay.
So the Montana economy was actually built on copper mining. And one of the bigger mines was the Berkeley Pit mine. And they were, you know, digging a massive hole in the ground. And this is like those big excavators that are huge, and the dump trucks that are 10 times the size of a normal dump truck that we'd have. And they're digging a hole in the ground to mine copper. And eventually they shut the mine down in the early 80s. And the pit started to fill up with water. And all of this toxic heavy metals leach out of the bedrock into this pit that's filling up with water. And it's so toxic that a flock of geese landed in it last year and all 200 geese died. So this is really nasty water. And so they're trying to clean it up, and they can't clean it up fast enough. And now they're looking at it and they're saying, we've spent so much money trying to clean up this mine that we actually have spent more money trying to clean it up than we ever made mining in the first place.
Wow.
And that's a big part of why we've really pulled back on a lot of the mining practices that we have. And the problem is that a lot of the other countries in the world haven't gone through those lessons yet.
Yeah.
So trying to get that dollar figure of what is it going to cost really involves completely understanding all the way through what the impact is going to be. We have this in our community, and you look at how much it costs to clean up Avila Beach.
Yeah.
Right? Right. This is a big deal, and I imagine if they had gone back, you know, 100 years ago and known what it was going to eventually cost them, either they would have done it differently or they wouldn't have done it at all.
Yeah.
And so that kind of situation is happening all around the world in every different type of industry.
And I'm going to take a break here and reintroduce my speakers here. The guests that I have are Kyle Weens, CEO and co-founder of iFixit, Aaron Gomez, newly elected San Luis Obispo City Council member and co-owner of The Gold Concept, and Lynn Ann Weiss, store manager of Humankind Fair Trade, a nonprofit retail store. You're listening to KCBX, your public radio station at 90.1 FM San Luis Obispo, 91.7 FM Salinas to Paso Robles, and 89.5 Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web at kcbx.org. Everything we buy comes from somewhere to be available to us, and it goes somewhere when we're done with it. My guests today represent three companies whose businesses are based on this understanding. They're here today to share their thoughts about the importance of being mindful consumers, especially during the holidays right now, because we're in the midst of them. And with that focus in mind, that's the topic. If you'd like to join us, you could call. Our show is live, and bring your questions to 781-3875. We'd love to hear from you. Again, that's 781-3875. When we talk about organic cotton and the differences, can you give me a broader description of what those differences are and how that impacts?
That's probably not my personal expertise.
Okay.
I'll go back to the video, the true cost again, because that was really informative to me. If you're interested in this topic, that's a really good place to start. Just thinking about the farmers in India that are growing cotton, there's so many of them that are just unable to provide for their families in and are unable to have sustainable farms using conventional pesticides and that sort of thing. I mean, there's farmers who are committing suicide over just how hopeless their situation is. So the organic movement is something that I know we need to work on more. And it's something that we're working on in the fair trade world. One of the principles of fair trade is really working on the environment and making sure that we're taking care of our planet. But it's just one of our principles. So it's something we're moving towards more and more, especially as customers are demanding more fair trade or more organic and more sustainable sources of materials.
I think Patagonia has switched pretty much completely
to organic
cotton. And that was partially a result of some of the challenges they had in their retail stores. They had one store where their employees kept getting sick, and they did air quality tests in the store, and they learned that it was the formaldehyde coming off of their clothing.
Yeah.
And so that was a wake-up call for them, and they said, okay, well, we could install better ventilation in the store, but that's not going to address the root cause, which is that the products that we're making are toxic. And it's really shocking how much – I mean, the cotton fibers, in order to break them down, they use formaldehyde a lot. Like anytime you have a wrinkle-free garment, usually it was treated with formaldehyde because that breaks down the cotton and it doesn't wrinkle as much. And I like wrinkle-free garments. I like not having to iron. And so it's hard to find the sustainable approaches to this. And that's where it's cool to see someone who's local like Patagonia, where they're putting in a lot of hard research and development to figure out better ways of accomplishing this without some of the nasty chemicals.
When we're trying to teach our kids this, is this something that you see as being really important too? Because we're bringing up another generation of consumers and thoughtless consumers. First, kids don't tend to think in terms of outside of themselves for I want it and so-and-so has it and it would be cool to have. But how do we integrate that? And is that important?
We have a lot of folks where we have kids fixing iPods for their kids. I was for their parents. I was talking with one mom, and she said she's getting her son a iPhone screen repair kit for Christmas. He's not getting a new phone. He's getting the part, and then he's expected to do
it's
repair
great
himself.
Idea.
And I think that's a way to, one, save money and also instill kind of some new ideas. My grandfather would go to Goodwill and buy electronics for us to take apart. And that was kind of how we learned to tinker.
And those are your toys.
Those are our toys.
That's great.
And you don't need new things.
Yeah.
Totally happy with existing things.
Yeah. And in the jewelry industry, you can melt, if someone wanted a different kind of a piece, a ring, got divorced and remarried, you can repurpose those diamonds or the gold and create something completely new.
Yeah, I mean that is what's so great about our trade is that we do that. We do that quite often. Even mm-hmm. my dad used to do that all the time. I've even had the chance to redo one of the rings that my dad originally did, and we actually kept the main portion of it intact, and I basically added pieces on. So we made a new piece of jewelry out of the old, without ever having to put new gems in it or new gold or anything. It was just my labor and his labor combined in that same piece. And I think that's the whole reality of this consumer idea is you do teach the next generation and you teach through example. I mean, children always want to emulate what they see around them. So if mm-hmm. you show them the importance of repurposing and, the more necessity-based endeavors when we buy something, I think that gets carried on.
I think there's been a growing number of repurposing clothing, repurposing stores in this community. Is that similar to what you're seeing in other areas, Kyle? Is it something that we as American consumers are becoming a little bit more aware?
I think so. I think we're certainly seeing a lot more electronics repair shops popping up. You've got iMechanics here in town. There's about 10,000 new cell phone repair stores in the U.S. that didn't exist 5 years ago. So that's very exciting. But then you also have some of our tried and true traditional. We've got Tackens repairing shoes. And I would encourage you, if you're thinking about getting new shoes for Christmas, don't.
Get them repaired.
Go take it to Tackens and have them repair them.
Yeah.
And the more that and you can give that as a gift, right? Like go and find something from your spouse's closet that needs to be repaired or that they might be throwing away. Get it fixed, wrap it up and put it under the tree. Or fix it yourself. And I think, you know, if we can add labor to the products that we already have, we don't have to worry about all the material inputs up front. They've already been put into it. There's just so much more authenticity in a product that has a story behind it, in something that you can find or that you can get from a friend and add value to.
You know, it's interesting. I read an article maybe about a year ago that was talking about the millennial generation and how there are individuals of my parents' generation and even my generation of the baby boomers who, you know, have stuff that has been left to us from grandparents or parents, and people not wanting it anymore, really not wanting to take ownership of that, and the stories are lost. I mean, they go to a garage sale or a repurposed store, but it doesn't stay with the family. Is that something that we're beginning to see a shift in? Because you talk about the stories as being part of, you know, and the stories for you too, Lynette, are part of the uniqueness of the quality of the product.
Our tagline is handmade stories of hope. So that's what we're all about. Everything in our store does have a story behind it, whether it's women in Uganda who are making sandals to earn enough money to go to college, or people in Mexico who are weaving tapestries and are really weaving their heart and soul into every piece that they make. Everything comes from somewhere. And when you buy fair trade, everything has a really significant story behind it.
We're going to take a call from Yannick. Are you there, Yannick?
Yes.
Hi, did you have a comment or question?
Yes, you know, some of my grandchildren have told me about an enormous amount of waste in their school district, from drafting tables being thrown into dumpsters because the superintendent wanted to show off a room to maybe a corporation that wanted to donate money to start a program, to having black marble countertops smashed to make room for a computer lab. Mm-hmm. And it was formerly an art studio for the school district. Is there any way to create, like what you mentioned before about Craigslist, maybe a Craigslist among school districts, so teachers who are begging for materials and equipment and facilities, that maybe there could be maybe a free exchange between school buildings and school districts. I don't know. Is that a concept that can be done?
Yeah, that's a great, great suggestion, Yannick. I know of a program that's in place at the University of Minnesota that's doing phenomenal things there, where they actually make enough money off of collecting things that aren't being used anymore and then reselling them or repurposing them, and they've built internal accounting mechanisms to account for the savings. So they actually have dedicated staff. I think they have a couple of staff where all they do is run the reuse program and make sure that material gets recirculated within the university. And I'd be interested. I'm not sure if Cal Poly's sustainability program does similar things on campus. But I think that's the kind of thing that you need. You need a concerted focus on it, because it's always easier to go and buy something new and throw something away. Like, we're really good at this linear economy thing where we dig stuff out of the ground, we make things out of it, we use it for a little while, and then we toss it away. Like, our landfills are really efficient and our mines are really efficient. It's not nearly as efficient to figure out, hey, I've got this marble countertop from the school, where else can I use it? And that's where things like Craigslist have come and helped.
Yeah.
But clearly it sounds like the school district could be doing a little bit more to to focus on that. And I think maybe that there's an opportunity for volunteers to get involved there.
Well, then it sounds like in the situation that you cited that the organization itself kept control of that. I think sometimes what happens when there's remodeling or building is that it's turned over to the contractor who just
right.
is into the demolition and removal.
Right.
So
yes.
there's nobody really responsible for that.
Right. When we built our building, we took over the old coal automotive building, and the contractors that we hired, like, their default is just come in and destroy everything.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to be there basically babysitting them and saying, no, those windows, you're taking those windows out and they're going to be intact and we're going to reuse them. And it was a mind shift for them and it was more work, but I was willing to pay them to do the work. Yannick, does that sound like the kind of thing that you're thinking of?
Yes, and it would be great for some organization maybe to put somebody who's competent or has the awareness for this into these institutions, and then maybe students can then take over
and learn from it.
Guidance and awareness.
Right. Well, and you know, this is actually something on the electronic side of things. I can really only speak to Slo High because I'm most familiar with them. But the computer repair program at Slo High has been phenomenal at reusing and repurposing things. And they, you know, they collect electronics from the community, repair them, resell them. They've used it to train their students, and they consistently win the national computer repair competitions. So they've got this dialed in, or they did until 2 weeks ago. If you hadn't heard, unfortunately, their lab got burned down. So we've been fundraising to rebuild it for them. But I think that that's exactly the type of operation that we need to support, and we just need to go beyond computers.
Yeah, thank you for calling, Yannick. That's a great suggestion. It'd be
a great
one for you to send into the school district, too.
Yeah, let them know.
All right.
Thank you. So when we talk about something that's ethically produced, okay, what does that mean?
Well, in fair trade, that has several different facets. We have 9 principles of fair trade. Our store is a member of the Fair Trade Federation, so all of the companies that we carry at Humankind are vetted by the Fair Trade Federation. So there's several different principles. I won't name them all, but it includes equal opportunities for women, so making sure that all workers are empowered. There's no child labor. There's caring for the environment, of course, as well as long-term relationships between the buyers and the producers, so that if the producers are suddenly they're seeing a decline in what they're selling, the buyers will come in and say, let's work on designing some new products that you can sell. So when it comes to fair trade, it covers a lot of different areas of production, but that's what we're working on.
And the store that you have, you said is it certified or it's a member?
So yeah, we're a member of the Fair Trade Federation. So people often ask us, you know, how are you so sure that people are being treated fairly?
Sure.
How do you know that they're getting paid fair wages?
Right.
And that's where a company or an organization like the Fair Trade Federation comes in. All the members of that federation have been screened. So that is retailers like Humankind and also wholesale companies that we buy from. We're all members of that Fair Trade Federation. And then the federation does do some monitoring and evaluation to make sure that we're abiding by those principles.
What are some of the obvious things that people can do quickly besides, you know, look at whether or not you can repair something? What are kind of the low-hanging fruit, if you will, for
sure? I think the easiest thing is cell phone batteries. Every phone needs a new battery after 18 months to 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes these batteries...
Not a new phone, but a new battery.
You don't need
battery.
A new phone, you just need a new battery. And so okay. people feel like they're... Like if your phone is maybe running a bit slower than it used to, or if your phone shuts off before it gets all the way down, right? So you could be a third battery and then the phone just shuts off.
Right.
That's just your battery wearing out. And batteries wear out just like the tires on your car wear out. It's normal. It doesn't mean you need a new phone. It just means you need a new battery. And it used to be really easy to swap a battery. You just, right,
pull
the battery off the back of the phone.
Pop it in, yeah.
But it's not like that anymore. And
no.
and it's still possible to replace batteries on these phones, but you have to know a little bit ahead of time. So in order to find out if you can swap the battery on your phone easily or not, go to iFixit.com, punch in your phone model. And so if you punch in iPhone 6, you'll see that it actually is very straightforward to replace the battery in an iPhone 6, but you need some special tools. And so we sell batteries with the tools included.
On iFixit.com.
Right. So in the case of the iPhone, you need a special screwdriver. Apple decided that regular screwdrivers weren't good enough for them. They wanted you to have a special screwdriver. So the battery comes with the fancy Apple screwdriver. With other phones, it can be easy. Some phones, it's pretty much impossible to replace the battery, and it's a disposable device. Like the HTC One and the HTC M8 are examples of phones where they're basically disposable. You use them for 18 months to 2 years, and then you'll recycle the phone. And that's a shame. So if you're thinking about getting a gift of a new phone, make sure you check out iFixit and you look at our repairability
Which ones can be replaced.
Right, so you'll have a good idea.
Good
if I'm buying something, am I buying something I'll be able to use just for 2 years, or is it possible to last for 4 or 5?
That's great tips. And for you, Aaron, too, what about in your line of business? What are some things that are kind of low-hanging fruit, or what you think consumers should really know about the jewelry industry or when they're shopping for jewelry?
The low-hanging, a lot of it just knowing that you can literally recycle everything that you have. If there's a lot of jewelry in your jewelry box that you're not using, rather than just let it sit there, bring it in, you trade in. It's basically, gold has its own monetary value.
A set level.
Yeah, and it's very easy to calculate. You can look at the daily market. Obviously, doing trade-in and then repurposing that, you don't get generally the 100% cost of that jewelry because there's a lot of labor built into making that product too. But we oftentimes will repurpose people's old jewelry or take it in on trade, and we literally send it to a refinery. It gets turned into new gold ingots, and then they ship it out for whatever their manufacturing process is.
Lynanne, what are some of the things that seem to be selling well this year for you out of your shop?
Yeah.
Obviously, you don't have like the little toy things that people are clamoring over right now. But
we have great gifts for so many people. We carry clothing, accessories, kitchen items, home decor items, as well as some fair trade foods. So there's something you can find for almost anyone. Things that are really flying off the shelves right now are ponchos.
Ponchos.
and lots of accessories. Jewelry. We have some really great new lines of jewelry. There's one company that's called Starfish Project, and they specifically employ women who have escaped from sex trafficking in Asia, and they help them just rebuild their lives but also gain some income through making jewelry. So that's one of the new lines we've brought in that's doing really well. Jewelry is always one of our highest categories. And when you think about what you want to do to shop ethically, if you're going to buy gifts already, if you're doing Christmas shopping, it's so easy to just find something that is ethical, whether it's fair trade or locally made. There's lots of options on Etsy of, handmade, American-made things. There's so many options out there, and it's really not that hard.
And what it gets back to is what you were talking about is the story, again, having a story around what people purchase. What else in terms of major concerns? You talked about, I loved a comment that you had written in the stuff that you provided me, you vote with your dollars.
Oh, yes.
With the dollars that you spend. What did you mean by that?
Money is powerful. And right now it seems like the main consumer market is supporting businesses that are not practicing good ethical standards. So if we can just decide to spend money at businesses that are doing something good for the world, it can dramatically change our culture and our economy and the lives of people all around the world. So you do vote with your dollars. You vote for the kind of world you want to see.
I think it was interesting that there was this week there was a lot of publicity around the fact that there were major American companies that had to that were fined heavily for having wonderful sales with 40%, 50% sales when they actually were jacking up the prices artificially going into the sales, which is no surprise. But so when we're talking about thinking that we're getting a great deal and spending a lot less money too, not necessarily always the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. I think there's a lot of psychology involved in what we think something is worth and what it's actually worth. So that's something that I really appreciate about fair trade is that it sets prices based on what something is actually worth and what it costs to produce an item, rather than what how much money they think they can get for it and what they think the market can bear.
Kyle, I want to get back to what you had said because I think it's a point that really needs to be reiterated, that when we look at the cost of something, it's the overall cost of having produced that. It's not just what we're paying out of our ATM account. It really is what it took to produce those things. I saw one time, just an outline of what it costs to bottle a bottle of water and the amount of gallons of water that are wasted to produce that one bottle of water, which is so ironic.
Right. Yes, it's very easy to lose track of the overall impact and the material chain. And so you can look at it. I mean, the amount of – it takes 70 gallons of fresh water to make a single microchip. And that water is –
how much?
70 gallons of water to
for
make
one
a microchip. Yes. And the electronics – the amount of energy and resources that go into electronics is much more concentrated than in other products. That's part of why we tend to focus a lot on electronics, because they have a much greater material impact than you would think by just looking at it. And it's surprising how many things have electronics in them. I took apart a Keurig coffee machine the other day because I was curious what was inside. Turns out the Keurig had more electronics in it than my cell phone did. There's a massive amount of circuitry inside of all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And so we're seeing that move all the way through the system where we have increasingly concentrated amounts of effort in these, you know, pristine, shiny things that we get. We don't realize what's happening upstream. We don't realize that, you know, it could be like the tin. It turns out that the tin that went into iPhones was came out of informal mines in Indonesia, where they're digging these pits, and then they don't have safety systems in place, and a number of these pits have collapsed in on workers. This type of thing happens consistently over and over and over again. We have to figure out a way to put more traceability on the supply chain, hold companies accountable. But I think we also, as consumers, bear a large part of the blame there, because we're the ones demanding cheaper and cheaper products, more and more products all the time.
Yeah, and using more and more,
using them
for less periods of time. So I have a question about an iFixit thing, printers. You know, you frequently hear they're so cheap, you can't fix them, you should just get a new printer. Can you fix printers?
Sometimes. Printers can be frustrating. It totally depends on what it is. Again, you know, try to buy on the higher end of the spectrum. The laser printers tend to be easier to maintain and repair than the inkjet.
And again,
printers.
They're a higher cost, but they last longer. Right. And you can repair them.
Absolutely.
Final words, we have about a minute. So really, final thoughts, Kyle?
I think the bottom line is to buy fewer things, buy better things, and then the things that we buy, use them for as long as possible.
Great.
Yeah, and I'll just dovetail on that. It's the same idea. I think before you buy anything, really look at necessity. Like, and I ask yourself that question, do I need this? And what is the longevity of this?
Does the person I'm buying it for need it?
Exactly.
Will they use it? Will they enjoy it?
Yeah.
I agree with both of those things. But then also when you are choosing to buy something, find something that is produced ethically if you can. Not everything you can find ethically, but a lot and a growing number of items that you need are.
And maybe spend more time creating the story around what you're giving, mm-hmm. you know, and having a story with it rather than just buying something that happens to be on sale. I want to thank my guests for today's show, Kyle Weens, CEO and co-founder of iFixit, a global repair community, Aaron Gomez, newly elected San Luis Obispo City Council member, congratulations, and co-owner of The Gold Concept, and Lynn-Ann Wiest, store manager for Humankind Fair Trade, a nonprofit retail store. Next week on Central Coast Voices, Fred Monroe will be joined by Lauren Weir, San Luis Obispo County Homeless Services Director Jim Patterson, President for ECHO and North County Homeless Shelter, and Lisa Frazier, Executive Director for Central Coast League. They're going to be talking about the unmet needs of the homeless population. We appreciate your suggestions for future shows, and if you want to send those in, you can do so at voices@kcbx.org. I'm Chris Kington, and I thank you for joining me today on Central Coast Voices.